now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. I'm Phil Lairness. And in Sydney, Australia, this is Mr. Dean Haglund.
Hi, Dean Haglund from Sydney, Australia, from around the world and underneath.
Wait, your day is just getting started. How do you sound so exhausted?
I know, right? Because it's bloody early in the morning. I've been up since 4 a.m.
Well, that's exciting. I mean, has any of that been involving preparations for the opening of a big comedy club?
Oh, sure has. That's exactly what it's been. As you may or may not know, we have a pop-up comedy club called the Hilarium opening up for as part of the Sydney Fringe Festival. And it's a daily excitement of building stages, getting interior design together, ticketing, websites, hilarium.com.au, contracts, the whole schmeal.
people love showing up at the pop-up comedy clubs to watch contracts being signed. That is hilarious.
Well, if you remember late Lenny Bruce, his whole thing was the transcriptions from his lawsuit. So I thought we'd continue on that vein in that kind of cutting-edge comedy that Lenny Bruce did.
Right, the cutting-edge comedy that resulted in him dying penniless and alone.
Right, but that's not to say he wasn't an artist. So
yeah, but I don't know if at that point he was anymore. I think he'd pretty much lost it. I think he'd lost his marbles. But we're very excited. So what are you saying, 3 weeks from now?
3 weeks from now. There'll be a soft opening that'll be a private invite only, so if you want to go to that, let me know. And then September 1st, Friday, we open with big name acts from all around Sydney, some sketch comedy, some improv, some stand-up. Some of the best from around the country will be performing at this very new brand new performance venue in Sydney.
That's very exciting. And this is ramping up right at the time where your art show in Los Angeles is closing. I think we're recording this on your Monday, my Sunday, and I think today for me is the very last day, or yesterday was the very last day down at the Fine Arts Building of your Broadway walking tour Watercolors.
Ah, is that right? Well, that makes sense, I guess, because they have to put a new show in. But yes, it went very well, highly acclaimed and well received. Or is it the other way around? Well received and highly acclaimed?
I don't know. I would like to hear some of the reception and acclaim.
Some of the reception and acclaim.
Yeah.
Well, the books that the show is based on, of course, sold very well. I'm down to my last 300 of all things. So that's a popular item right there. And then I sold a couple pieces, and a couple other pieces have interest, air quotes around it, interest, and then the show moves to a private salon in a loft in downtown Los Angeles, where it will continue for the next month or two. I'm not sure of the details, but selected works from that show will maintain its presence in downtown LA couple months.
So how does that work? How do people find out about, or, I mean, is the private salon open to the public, or is it by appointment? How does this work?
I think it's by appointment and or invite only. I've been to just a couple of soirees at this loft, and it's only because I know somebody. So I think it's you got to get art meets architecture. Is that you buzzing or me?
I don't know, but look, audio. There's going to be so many audio problems. The least we can do is not call attention to them.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I didn't know who. I thought that was a showstopper right there.
Yeah, I have no idea. Our levels are all over the place. People, if you're listening and this doesn't sound like a very good show, we know. But honestly, we still love you.
The good news is,
yes,
fiber optic has been installed in our neighborhood finally. Part of the National Broadband Network of Australia is now available in the Newtown area. And so on Thursday, we are getting upgraded to be part of that fiber optic line.
Well,
so
that's very exciting. That's very exciting. I cannot wait to hear that. Although, am I wrong in thinking that you started to say Los Angeles and what came out was Australia?
Maybe that might have happened, but
that's your new show about shuttling back and forth between LA and Sydney. It's Lostralia.
Oh,
hey,
I like it.
Two conversations that really kind of tickled me, actually, when all was said and done this week. One that I simply overheard, and one in which I was an active participant, though at some point I actually left my body and heard the conversation from the outside and was...
Even though you're in it.
Yes, staggered by how ridiculous it was. And where the art of conversation has gone really stunned me and forced me out of my body. But the first conversation, while I was walking, Ferndale, Griffith Park, on my way to meet one of my acting students, and two women were walking towards me, and woman one says, first... I love that I am going out dancing. And second, I love that I'm doing it in Frogtown. Woman number two replies, what's Frogtown? Woman number one says, exactly. Even though woman number two actually wasn't being sarcastic, she wanted to know what is Frogtown.
What is Frogtown?
Yeah, so there you go. So
that is good. The question should be, where is Frogtown? Which the answer is down by the LA River, of course.
But
one of the most older neighborhoods.
But now you're starting. Yeah, but then after that, you do get into the what is it, because they are two different questions. You know, if you ask what is it, technically, actually, I think what is it covers where is it. Because if I were to ask you what is Frogtown, isn't the first part of your explanation where it is? And then you would get into historically why it has developed the moniker Frogtown.
I see, but wouldn't...
But the where would not include the historic necessarily. Of the
true.
What is its moniker. So we have taken, though, an idiotic exchange and done nothing to elevate it. So secondly, I was on the midweek drive this week. I think Siren FM's recording schedules are all over the map because there are renovations being done in the Siren FM studios. So during the day, they don't have live programming. They have pre-recorded programming, which we know a little something about. But I have been also doing weather for Siren FM live. Because who better to give weather readings in the UK than someone in Los Angeles? But I got involved in an exchange with Liz Brewer. I think she's a publicist. She's a beloved fan of a friend of so many people over there, and seems like a lovely lady, and is certainly nothing short of a Donald Trump apologist. But we got into this exchange because. She was talking, somehow she was expressing something and was talking about all the planning that Trump did in order to win, how he knew he was going to win. That was the point of the thing. He always knew he was going to win, and that's why he won. And I just brought up, well, then why are there so many people close to the president who have said that him winning was such a surprise and that that's why they were behind the gun on preparing the transition? Why they didn't do it. And she said, well, no, they did a beautiful job, of course, of creating the transition. But whatever.
What?
But she said, no, he always knew he was going to win. And I said, okay, but what about the people around him that have said that he didn't, that it was a surprise? And she then hit me with, and this is the part that I love, well, that's your opinion. And that's the moment I left my body. Because this is where we're at now in terms of discourse. I'm asked... I'm told that that's my opinion, but I didn't express an opinion. It wasn't my opinion. I was asking about the opinion others, in this case, people close to the president, have expressed. Uh-huh. But, well, that's just your opinion. Reporting what other people have said is simply my opinion. And I was so, I don't know, oddly charmed by that I couldn't stop laughing. Otherwise, I would have pointed out that one of these people close to the president who has said that he was really surprised that he won was, on several occasions, the president.
Right.
Because on several speeches, he said that. And in fact, he explained that had he known he was going to win, if he believed he was going to win, he certainly wouldn't have had the victory party in such a rinky-dink small ballroom. That's what he said.
And also, and leading up, there was also, if I don't win, this is all fixed. That was a big mandate. And,
oh, well, that's true, too. But even after the fact, rather refreshingly said that it was a surprise to him that he won. Now, you can tell me that, well, that's just him talking and that's a game that he plays and all that. But anyway, but the point is, I love how apologists for Trump have literally lost any discernment whatsoever.
And not just discernment, but willingness to even chat about issues anymore. You know, I got some friends who seem to be pro-Trump.
Yeah, to even chat, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and to just have an exchange of ideas going, look, aside from whatever my beliefs are, I would like to hear how... in light of much of this information, what you still find positive that you can still hang your hat on and be a supporter of him.
Yeah.
And, fake news aside and stuff. Well, you can't even have that conversation.
And that's disappointing because, I have, as you know, I've gone on record. I would never criticize anyone for have voted, I don't criticize people based on who they vote for. I might criticize who they vote for, but not the people for voting for them. And in this particular instance, I understand, and we talked about this years ago even, I understood why people were supporting him. I understood why so many people felt disenfranchised and unseen. I do recognize a lot of the anger and the frustration.
Absolutely.
But what I am interested in, apropos of what you're saying, is it seems to me quite often that the policies being argued for by the administration and in some cases being enacted by the administration often treat his supporters the worst. And I would love to have that conversation about how these things are affecting them, but you can't. You seemingly can't.
You cannot. Well, because it's politicized. And also this idea now that truth is politicized. This is even, to me, more disconcerting, because then it's, if you are speaking of a fact that you heard of or reporting another fact it is known, then it's either fake or there's a different fact that
or it's your opinion, as it was in this case.
Yeah.
I was reporting the fact that other people have said this.
Right.
Not that what they said was necessarily factual, but asking about why would they say this, right? Anyway, we've gone on longer than I guess. But yes, this kind of discernment, and discernment is so important if one is going to have friendly conversation, it seems.
Absolutely, because as you always say, there's got to be something right with the hand you're dealt with.
Oh, yes. It serves in some way.
It serves in some way. And so I am delighted. I'm so looking forward to finding how this serves in some way. Because at the moment, other than tons of hilarity comedy late night. There's it seems it's not serving anybody in any way.
Well, I think the breakdown, you know, this healthcare debate hit such a crux, such an impasse, where suddenly how it serves is people have to stop hiding now behind tribe, and they actually all on both sides of the aisle are now stuck with this thing and have to figure out really what we want healthcare to be and start fixing it. They're going to have to do it because we've gotten to the point where the tribe versus tribe rhetoric and posturing has led to impasse after impasse after impasse, and everyone is now on the hook. And that's what's important. It's almost like with this president, there is no party in power or out of power anymore. You're all liable for everything that happens. So you better start to work. And so that is a unique opportunity that could very easily serve. We'll see what they do.
Well, there
we'll see
go.
What they do with it. That's
the optimism I've been looking for.
A delightful letter from a listener. It begins, "Hey, Dean and Phil, how are you?"
That's us. Hey, we're good. Speaking for you and me.
I'm a proud member of Chill Pack Nation, listening to you all the way from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Hey!
Or as I like
fantastic.
To call it, Brasil.
Very good.
I started, you know, I've been to Brasil. Anyway, I started to listen to Chill Pack Hollywood Hour just a couple years ago, but I became really addicted to your show. Listening does become addictive. It really, really
it does.
I discovered CHH in a time when I was struggling with a deep depression, and one of the many things that were going wrong with my life then was my job. I was a designer in a huge e-commerce company, but I wasn't allowed to be truly creative. This was killing me. I'm telling you because I used to listen to CHH while I was there, quote, tightening screws, like Chaplin in modern times.
Ah, fantastic.
I have serious trouble focusing on one thing, and I wasn't performing the way my bosses wanted, neither the way I would like to work. Then I realized how the show helped me stay focused and to go through my days working a bit more like I was supposed to. You became such an inspiration for me. If I could listen to you talking about movies, history, art, and aesthetics for my whole life, I'm sure it wouldn't be a wasted life. I dare to say that daily doses of your show did more for me than any antidepressant could do.
We are all about the SSRI uptake inhibitors, I got to tell you.
I mean, the Senate, in trying to fix healthcare, may want to consider daily doses of your Chill Pack Hollywood.
There's 500 episodes.
Oh, my God. And if we could get just some of those government kickbacks, we could fix the audio problem. Anyway, which brings me finally to the reason why I'm writing you. For quite some time, I wondered if I could send something positive back to you, since you did a lot for me. And of course, you didn't even know that. Then I got this idea, and I've been working on this on my free time for the past couple of years. So attached to this email is my gift, a design project for CHH. It was the way I found to be creative as I needed. Sorry for the long email. Love you guys. All the best. Julia Morena. I cut out the part of the email where she explains in depth the design project, because obviously people listening to us can't see the design. But Dean Haglund, as soon as we are off the show, I am forwarding this to you so that you can look at it.
Oh, my gosh.
It is a very impressive undertaking, I must say. I was going to say, I mean, the work itself is impressive, but I mean, it's both impressive and ambitious. How about that?
Wow, that's two things I lack.
Well, she's giving you those things. So thank you, Julia, for the email itself was enough.
Absolutely.
We love hearing
I'm very
from people.
Impressed. Absolutely. And considering my focus is all over the place, maybe I should listen to our show every day just to get focused.
Well, that's why not, I say.
Well, because I heard it before, I think. But anyway.
I want to talk about a few movies before we get to the massive amount of celebrity deaths that sadly we must cover. And before we get to new movies, I'll talk about a couple that sadly actually tie into celebrity deaths. Though in the case of the first one, I didn't know it when I rewatched it. I rewatched Francois Truffaut's directorial debut, the 1959, The 400 Blows.
400 Blows, such a great film.
Oh my goodness. It manages to be both a heartbreaking movie. It's about a young boy who gets put into the mm-hmm. corporal punishment system, the juvenile mm-hmm. detention system in France. It's both a heartbreaking film, and it's this incredibly uplifting film because of how beautiful it is.
Yeah, it's remarkably shot and in black and white, and just that period before the French New Wave, sort of the. Well,
it's kind of the launch of it, right? I mean, it's Truffaut's first becoming a filmmaker after being a longtime writer for Cahiers du Cinéma, and it's mm-hmm. right at that time when the new wave is starting. But it led me to, looking up all the accolades and the legacy of the film. It's been on so many top 10 lists. We talk sometimes about the Sight and Sound poll that is conducted every 10 years of the greatest films ever made. And it's a poll of both critics and historians and filmmakers. And it was 39th on the list in 2012 of the greatest films ever made. Filmmakers mm-hmm. As varied as Akira Kurosawa, Louis Buñuel, Satyajit Rai, Jean Cocteau, Richard Lester, he of Help and Hard Day's Night, and Norman Jewison, all have cited The 400 Blows as one of their favorite movies. But what I was intrigued by was I found a film, a list that was published by the British Film Institute a couple years ago of the 50 films you should see by the age of 14. They published this list, and it's a really good list. I mean, we're not going to go through all 50 films now, though maybe we could go through a couple at a time each week.
But the
reason behind this was the British Film Institute realized we're entering an age where there's so much entertainment available to young people that really mm-hmm. the historic opportunity is for educators and parents to start taking seriously the introduction of cinema as an important and influential art form to children. And to start teaching it in schools, and if you're a parent, to continue your own education by watching these films with your children. And I think that's an extraordinary idea. And so obviously, if we go chronologically, 400 Blows is well down the list because it's 1959. Yeah. Another film that's on that list from that year, Some Like It Hot, that you should show that to your children before they're 14. A couple of films.
I can see that.
That are right out of the gate. The earliest film on this list is 1902's A Trip to the Moon.
Yes, oh my gosh. That is surrealism, but it's also, you got to consider that at the time, that was cutting-edge science fiction, too.
And if you're showing this to a child about their, introducing them to the history of cinema, does it look funny? Does it look silly compared to some of the things they may see? They may have already encountered on television, of course. But if you ask them, all right, how did they do it?
Right.
Because
how did they accomplish that?
Aren't kids intrigued by the idea of, more so than adults, I think, about how was the trick accomplished?
Yes, the magic.
Yeah.
How does this happen?
And finding out about the why of it for a child doesn't make it less magical.
Absolutely. And plus, you think about the visual grammar, the vernacular at the time in 1902 is sort of how we all as a culture learn to see film, right? That you had to learn in steps, what's two-dimensional, three-dimensional, depth of field, all of that sort of thing. To see that now, it's good to go back to 1902 and go, these are just the basic elements of filmmaking. And then as you go up through history, you can see where, great revolutions in cinematography and sound and color and all of these things add to your knowledge, as opposed to seeing, you know, some big Transformers today and you're just overwhelmed.
So do you think this would be fun, not necessarily every week, but several weeks if we go through a couple of these and talk about why these are on the list?
Fascinating.
Okay.
Because also,
well, let's do one more.
I know my... Yeah.
Let's do one more if we can, because this is right up your alley. And I kind of, when I saw this, I was dying to ask what you thought of this. There's one silent feature on here. I think it's a feature, right? And it's 1921's The Kid.
Oh, yes.
And as you know, I showed my young goddaughter City Lights. I got to go and see it on the big screen. And she first of all, she spent the first half hour laughing hysterically, loving it. And then the next hour, she kind of was leaned forward on her seat, maybe no longer laughing as much, but really swept away in the story. And but why might the kid, if we can say that BFI got this right, why might the kid be a better choice for a film that someone should see by the age of 14 more so than City Lights?
Well, because it's a tale of an orphan that the unemployed chaplain tries to save. And this is highly, highly relatable. I mean, it's a relationship between a father figure and a son that is so deep and so crushing, and how the authorities try to take away and how Chaplin fights for the child. It reinforces an idea of a father-son bond, even in terms of adoption, that very few films, even today, explore in any way whatsoever. This, of course, is a rapid film. I think it comes in only at 40 minutes, but it is feature length. You know, as they called it then, it was a five-reeler. And it was one of the first big breaks for Chaplin as a terms of an artist growing, so that he wasn't just doing short little funny comedies anymore. He was developing both emotional breadth and storyline. So I could see The Kid being a phenomenal
movie introduction,
particularly if you've seen it with your dad.
And that's the hope, right? Is that some of these, not all of these, but some of these will turn kids on to further exploration on their own. And obviously Chaplin, then they get to go on and explore and even find perhaps greater masterworks too. You know, some of these films on here, like I would argue that maybe 400 Blows is Truffaut's best film. He made other masterpieces, but I don't know if he ever achieved the same, state. He certainly never made a film as popular in his native France as 400 Blows. But whereas with Chaplin, you get to go on in your explorations and maybe even reach higher peaks.
Absolutely.
So next week, why don't we discuss the films that are on this list from the 1930s? Because there are several interesting ones, I think, for you to talk about. I do want to point out one that I have not seen that is on here.
Oh.
And it is from 1998, and it's a Swedish film called Show Me Love. And it follows teens Ellen and Agnes, who are schoolmates. Ellen is upbeat and popular, while Agnes is morose and friendless. It sounds like us. And both girls are very frustrated with life. Ellen dreams of fleeing their dull Swedish town. Agnes dreams of Ellen. Though Agnes has never acted on her feelings. It's widely rumored she's a lesbian. But when Ellen kisses Agnes on a cruel dare, it leads to an apology, a growing closeness between the girls, and a plan to solve the problems of both. This might be a wonderful film. I'm sure for it to be on here, it must be a wonderful film. And I could understand why close friendship and sexual confusion in coming-of-age tale could be something for someone younger than 14, where you want to watch it with them and talk about it with them. But I've got to believe that if the film had not been released in the English-speaking world as Show Me Love, and instead had been released under its actual Swedish title, it might not have been included on a list that educators and parents would want to show their kids, the Swedish title being Fucking 'Em All.
I could see that being a rough...
What are we... What are we seeing in class today, Teach? Fucking Amal.
So wait, is it like Amal a male name or like a place where I go shopping for?
No, it's AMAL, probably an umlaut or something on there. I don't know what that what that would mean. It might be part of, you know, like it might mean like fucking hell for all I know. I don't know, but I do feel like you put the word fucking in there. That's probably a no-no for the under 14s, I'm thinking.
How'd
that one get on this list? What?
oh my gosh.
I mean, unless your dad is, I don't know, Hugh Hefner, you're not watching that with dad. Okay.
okay. Fantastic.
So, another older film that I saw that I wanted to touch on just really briefly. You know, I'm a huge fan of In the Heat of the Night, speaking of Norman Jewison, you know, starring Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger. And one of the things that I really love about the film and why every time it comes on, I get riveted by it, even though I know the plot and I know the mystery, is just how authentic the time and the place is on that. Set in Mississippi, the work that all the actors are doing, the atmosphere, the tone of it. It's I love place being a character, as you know. But I'd never watched either of the sequels. Sidney Poitier starred in two sequels, the first of which was They Call Me Mr. Tibbs. And although he is a Philadelphia cop in the Heat of the Night, it turns out in They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, he's been a cop in San Francisco for 15 years. So go figure. I finally saw it. It's directed by the workmanlike Gordon Douglas. Not a screen artist, but a man who made a couple fun movies.
There you go.
It's look, it's not a great film. The score by Quincy Jones is fun. He did the score in the Heat of the Night, and instead of a bluesy Mississippi score, it's a really funky, jazzy San Francisco-based score that would really clearly influence, I think, Lalo Schifrin throughout the 1970s. So that's fun. Sidney Poitier's performance is fun. But the reason I finally watched it was the second lead in the film is none other than Martin Landau, who we remembered a couple weeks ago. And he was fresh off Mission Impossible at that point. And boy, the emotional range of this guy. And here's a phrase for you. The relaxed intensity of Martin Landau. His characters are always so intense, but he brought a relaxed intensity to bear on all these
parts. It was as if he was tension free. You know, there's no, like, so often you see somebody will grit their jaw, tensil their jaw muscles, their shoulders up around their ears to make it like they're angry, intense.
Isn't that interesting? He's intense without being tense. You're right. Yeah. There's no tension.
There's no tension. It's all in the eyes, and I guess somewhere in the psyche.
Well, what looks like tension? Doesn't it? Tension reads when someone is fighting something, right? They're fighting something within themselves. They're fighting to get something out. But there's no fight in Martin Landau's performances. He lets the intensity flow.
Yeah.
Which is why he could play people that might be crazy, like Kurzweil in the X-Files movie, right? Is this guy a madman? We don't know. But we like him because he's relaxed. He's got this relaxed intensity.
And same with his Bela Lugosi in Ed Wood, how he made that guy both crazy and yet totally cool and relaxed at the same time.
How can a movie be a very good movie and a really bad movie all at the same time?
I don't know how.
When it's Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, as it turns out. Critics are loving this, seemingly more than audiences are. The box office has been good. I was holding out doubt that it might be better than I was hearing here in America from audiences, because America doesn't do quite so well with period pieces, especially when they don't know the history. And truthfully, this film doesn't give you a lot in terms of context over the Battle of Dunkirk, which, of course, was fought before America got into the war. And we still kind of, right. I think, believe that the war began with, you know, the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Whereas right. this movie ends with, of course, the Churchill speech about we'll fight them on the land, we'll fight them in the oceans, we'll fight them, you know, in the streets. But what people forget is that the end of that speech was, and we'll fight them until the new world comes to rescue the old world, you know, meaning until America joins the fight. But it's about a battle that involved the escape of some 300,000 troops, Allied troops, mm-hmm. British and French troops, from the beaches at Dunkirk when they were hoping they could rescue 30,000 to allow Britain to put up some resistance before a German invasion. Now, apparently there was a movie I have yet to see. I'm going to be watching it either later tonight or tomorrow from the 1950s, Dunkirk, starring John Mills. And this is a movie that supposedly has more meat on its bones in terms of the story. Much like I always thought the 1950s, A Night to Remember, the Titanic film, had more meat on its bones than the James Cameron film of the 90s. And, and the comparison is apt here because, look, the war stuff is phenomenal. The tension, the filmmaking, the aerial battles, this is all incredible. I feel like I'm there. I feel like this must be what they are. But they're all completely fictitious. There's no historic characters, there's no historic stories, there's no historic episodes. They are crafted entirely by Christopher Nolan. So, yes, I'm criticizing a movie for what it's not, which is giving me that sense of an inspirational tale torn from the pages of history. But also, he is trying something that is such an intellectual idea, which is to convey how the time of that event passed differently if you were one of the soldiers on the beach waiting to be rescued. The Battle of Dunkirk lasted for a week. If you were on one of the civilian boats that was being sent because the British government did not send military vessels to rescue them because they needed to save those vessels for a future invasion of England by the Axis powers. So they sent civilian vessels. And if you were on one of those vessels, the Battle of Dunkirk lasted a day, the amount of time it took to get across the channel and back. And if you were one of the few pilots, because again, they had to spare their planes, but if you were one of the few pilots sent to protect the civilian vessels and to fight enemy fighters that were up in the sky, it was a one-hour battle. And so you have three different timelines that are intersecting with each other at different times and then repeating at different times. And I can criticize that because it's a interesting idea that nevertheless serves to, at times, undercut the emotional impact. At other times, it serves to enhance it. But at some times, it doesn't. And so I'm happy that a period film is doing well because period films are a tough sell in America, especially if they don't have an award campaign behind them. But I feel much like those people who are saying, really, we get one movie about Dunkirk and this is it? It's all made up by Christopher Nolan. And boy, the French don't love it. Boy, he's angered the French.
Well, probably because he focused just on the English army and not the French army.
Absolutely. You see, you only see some French soldiers guarding the town who are accidentally shooting at British soldiers. And then you see one French soldier who lies and pretends to be a British soldier so that he can get rescued. That's the extent of the French in the film.
Wow. Okay. Well, and here's the thing. Dunkirk as a story is a story about a nation. Is about the English people rising up together, that the BBC put the call out, all ships get down to Dunkirk and save our boys. And, you know, it was the spirit that carried on through the Blitz and how the people rallied as opposed to falling apart, which surprised, the Germans and the Nazis thinking that a couple of bombs on London and the whole nation would collapse and give up. And the opposite happened. So of course, there's no single character that can exemplify, you know, a nation, as it were. I guess Kenneth Branagh is supposed to be doing that. But
yeah, I think, you know, they got people who were representative of the different walks of life. But this is also a 100-minute movie. And this is a tale, what you just described, what your description begs an epic film.
Yeah.
It really does.
I think it'd be,
not 100 minutes of only the action scenes. And that's what this is. And that's what this is.
So there's,
it's almost like Chris Nolan learned his lesson, but he learned it for the wrong film, trying to do a mea culpa for what went wrong with Interstellar, which was, as I've said, intermittently stellar, right? It was all fascinating space action punctuated by unwieldy and overwritten scenes and science.
Right.
And so he said, well, what if we cut out all those scenes with dialogue, science, and character and just keep the exciting stuff? And that creates the approach
to
Dunkirk.
100 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I just watched Suicide Squad, and I think that's the same issue. I think this was a much longer movie. And to me, it's not a fault of the writer-director. It's a fault of the editor, from what I've seen.
Well, we've talked about this, though, that they had to throw out the script. Because the film has no focus. And because they thought the movie was going to... Remember, people can go back and listen to past shows where we dissect this. But with the casting changing, the script was changing so fast. And that's always a recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. But I still thought I saw, in rewatching it, there was an edit save in that thing.
I got to tell you, I think the casting is undone in that movie. I think the movie's undone by the casting of Will Smith, to be honest with you, because you put him in it and you are putting out of balance your entire ensemble if you want it to be an ensemble piece. It has to be the Will Smith movie at that point. And that's not the movie that I think you saw in it that might have worked.
Right.
Anyway.
That's totally true.
So the other new one that I saw, speaking about character... you know, time and place being a character. No one creates this on the written page like Taylor Sheridan, who whose last two films as a screenwriter were Sicario, one of my favorite films of that year. I think a masterpiece for Denis Villeneuve. And then last year's Hell or High Water. And Taylor Sheridan's back with another script worthy of those scripts. This time he's directing, and it's his first time directing in almost a decade. And I would say that as a director, he is a very talented writer. It's a very good movie. I really like this movie. I'm going to criticize certain things about it because there's flaws to it that those other movies didn't have. And
what's it called?
It's called Wind River, and it's set on the Arapaho Reservation, which is larger than Rhode Island and Delaware put together. 14,000 Native Americans, 80%, more than 80% are unemployed, and the dropout rates are 40% higher on that reservation than anywhere else, so it is a bleak atmosphere for humans and a very challenging landscape geographically in which to live. The story revolves around a Native girl being found dead in the snow, having run barefoot 6 miles in the middle of the night in 20 degree below weather. What was she running from? What was she running to? We don't know. A FBI agent is called in, but it is the lowest rung, least experienced, most out of her depth FBI agent, because nobody cares about what goes on on the reservation. And the only help she can really find is from a hunter who is hunting lions who have been killing livestock in the area. And he knows how to read the snow. And that character is played by Jeremy Renner. And it is a very, very nice performance. He's a very interesting actor. Love him in Hurt Locker. Enjoyed him in so many other things.
Yep.
I have read that what people miss from this is the unparalleled dialogue that Taylor Sheridan writes. He writes this brilliant dialogue that nevertheless is so affecting because it comes off like plain speak in these other movies. And they miss that in this. And the dialogue's all there. The writing is every bit up to snuff. One issue is that Jeremy Renner underplays dialogue in a way that does not serve this particular material. That's not his strength. And the other thing is that this director has a tendency to approach the written material like the writer might. Oh, maybe because he was the writer. And so for the first time, this writer's material sometimes feels overwritten. There's one scene in particular where the White Hunter, played by Jeremy Renner, is with his one of his best friends, a Native man played by Gil Birmingham, playing a character, Martin, who's the father of the dead girl. And they talk about grief. And it is a startlingly honest scene that deals with grief in a way very few films, very few screenplays do. And damn, I want that scene to work. And damn, it's the scene that really sticks out in this film like a sore thumb and doesn't work. And it could have worked if a director had taken a different approach. And sometimes it really helps when the director is not the person who wrote it. They feel much more free to put the focus on a different character than the one who's speaking. Whereas when you're writing it, your focus does go to the person who's speaking.
Yeah, right? Because so, that's how you're,
You know, that's how it's coming. You're hearing that person and you're writing down what they're saying. And so here's a scene where Jeremy Renner is revealing his own grief and sharing it with his friend Martin, who's just lost a daughter. But the point of view of that scene ought to be on Martin, even though he's not speaking, even though he's just listening. But this Native American actor, and it only makes it worse that we're watching a white guy the whole time, and the Native actor is literally out of focus for the whole scene.
No.
Yeah. And this is a writer with limited directing experience who doesn't understand that actually there is nothing more riveting than watching someone listen and be affected by something.
And be affected. Because clearly if that person's lost a daughter, the speech should be affecting him and his loss.
Again, I really, really liked it because not enough films give me a sense of time and place and give me a sense of how people who live there are affected by their surroundings. And I got all of that and all the Native actors who are here, the great Graham Greene, Tantu Cardinal, they're all wonderful. And it's kind of a kick-ass action film, too, much like Sicario. You know, Sicario, I don't think action fans went to see it because I think they thought it was some highbrow thing about a chick FBI agent. I don't know what they thought. But it was like the best action film of that year. And sure enough, this is a great action film as well.
Well, now it's on my list.
All right. We've got some celebrity deaths to get to. So let's play this little sting, shall we?
Celebrity deaths.
Thank you, Garrett Watley. Yes. Boy, so many to get to. I mean, maybe we'll even save a couple of the biggies for next week. But lightning round first. Robert Hardy, who was probably most widely known these days for his role as the Minister for Magic, Cornelius Fudge, in the Harry Potter movies, has died at age 91.
Wow.
He probably first came to real great fame starring as veterinarian Siegfried Farno on the British series All Creatures Great and Small
from
1978 to 1990. He played Sir John Middleton in the 1995 Oscar-winning film Sense and Sensibility. He's also known for playing Winston Churchill in several TV shows, movies, and miniseries. And again, he was in four of the Harry Potter movies. He died, again, at age 91 at Denville Hall, a home for retired actors there in the UK.
Wow. I didn't know they had one there.
Patty Deutsch, a comedian and voice actress who often appeared, I remember her for her appearances on Match Game, died actually on the 26th of the July from cancer at 73. You probably remember her for other things, Dean. She was quite recognizable because of her distinctive red hair, her distinctive voice, her ridiculous answers on game shows like The Match Game. But she was also on game shows like Tattle Tales. Who doesn't love a good Burt Convy game show?
Am I picturing her correctly? She would often have the headband, the wild 70s printed pantsuits.
Maybe. Her husband was Donald Ross, a comedy writer. She was really a sketch comic and stand-up comic by trade, which made her a frequent guest on The Tonight Show, on Dick Cavett, on Merv Griffin. Her voice was very girlish and yet raspy. And it led to prolific work as a voice actor. 500 commercials she did. She was in such cartoons as The Smurfs, Capital Critters, and Monsters, Inc. But before settling into her seat on Match Game, she was a regular performer on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In.
So you might be right. I'm thinking of.
And she was a graduate of the improv comedy team, The Ace Trucking Company, and this more than anything might be why I wanted to bring this up. The Ace Trucking Company was an improv group that featured the likes of Fred Willard, and they were featured regularly on the Tom Jones variety show This Is Tom Jones. Do you know the variety show This Is Tom Jones or the Ace Trucking Company?
I know the Ace Trucking Company because that's along with the National Lampoon Radio Hour, The Establishment. Those were always venerated in terms of pre-Second City Improv Olympic times, where improv in the 60s, the radical 60s, had its beginning of a voice. And so, absolutely Ace Trucking Company I had heard of. I, however, have never heard of the Tom Jones Variety Hour. When was that show on?
This is Tom Jones.
Thing?
I don't know, but I need to find it. I mean, did he do sketches?
Too.
And might there not have been something about a New Mexican puppeteer?
That's exactly what I'm thinking. Is that New Mexican puppeteer song the intro to that sketch? Wouldn't that be hilarious? I still think that should be a sketch unto itself. You know, Mark Twain. Where were the three puppets again? I can't remember that song now.
I have a feeling that there may be a little bit of it during the end of this show. All right.
Fantastic.
Marianne Mabry is an award-winning actress, was an award-winning actress, and former member of Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater Company. Had to bring it up because we're going to be discussing Steppenwolf when we discuss another one of these celebrity deaths. She died at the age of 52 of cancer. She had been in more than two dozen Steppenwolf plays over the last four decades. Such plays as The Geography of Luck, Ghost in the Machine, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Diary of Anne Frank, Grand Concourse. Her film and television credits number about a dozen, beginning 20 years ago, including Tangled, The Company, Law and Order, and Blue Bloods. She was born in 1965 in Missouri. After moving to Illinois, attended Illinois Wesleyan University on a full acting scholarship, joined Steppenwolf in 93. I became aware of her when she was on the original Broadway cast of Tracy Letts' August Osage County, which I talked about when we did our top 10 all-time favorite. She played Karen Weston in August Osage County in the Tony-winning cast, so I would be remiss if I did not remember her. And also when she won a Best Actress, a Jefferson Award for Best Actress in a principal role for Steppenwolf's fantastic 2012 production of David Lindsay Abaire's Good People, which came close to making my list. So for very personal reasons, I wanted to remember Marion Maybury, 52 years of age.
That's very sweet.
That brings us to one of the two real icons that left us, Sam Shepard.
Yes. What a shock.
Boy, 73. And I guess it was a shock because he had kept very hidden the fact that he'd been suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, for quite some time.
ALS. I know. And that never came up, even when you heard about benefits for ALS. I had no idea he was suffering from that.
He was a familiar presence as an actor in films that ranged from Days of Heaven, The Right Stuff, for which he was Oscar nominated, and Baby Boom. You know, he could have just been a full-on movie star if he wanted to. His resemblance to that laconic idol of Hollywood's golden era, Gary Cooper, was no small thing. And
that's true.
And it made him appeal to all ages. It really did. If he had been born in an earlier era, honestly, couldn't he have just made a whole living doing nothing but Westerns?
Yeah. But how about a prolific playwright?
Well, I mean, but that's the thing, is he was a reluctant movie star. And, you know, he was always suspicious of a celebrity's luster. And, of course, he was a bona fide artist. He was driven by his need to write. You know, we mentioned Steppenwolf. Steppenwolf does not become Steppenwolf without the 1980 premiere of his play True West, which launches its leads, a couple guys by the name of John Malkovich and Gary Sinise, to stardom. Yep. They made their names in that. To a smaller degree, so too did Philip Seymour Hoffman and John C. Reilly really established their bona fides. They both had been working a lot as supporting actors, but they really elevated in consciousness when they starred on Broadway in the revival of True West. And famously, you know, they both switched off their roles every night in that
play. Right, yes. Alternating back and forth.
He had the Pulitzer Prize winning Buried Child. He famously dismantled the classic iconography of cowboys and homesteaders, of American dreams and white picket fences, and would rework the landscape of deserts and farmlands into his own very surreal environment at times.
Well, and surreal, I mean, Cowboy Mouth, if I recall correctly, is the two brothers on either side of the stage with a third character in the middle who is not described. But from what an acting teacher told me was that at the previews, Sam Shepard's dad came to the theater drunk and recognized the dialogue between the two brothers and stood up and started yelling at the boys. And instead of Sam Shepard being embarrassed, he just wrote down everything drunk dad said and put it into the next version of the play. Like, that's how intensely personal his playwriting was.
He, talk about prolific, 55 plays he wrote. His last Particle of Dread had its premiere just a couple years ago. And we mentioned his acting. He acted in more than 50 films and more than a dozen roles on television, including last year on a Netflix show. He had the memoir Motel Chronicles in 1982. And despite all of this, despite even becoming a name because of his work in movies, and despite his acclaim around the world, he never actually became a mainstream commercial playwright. He was never married to Jessica Lange, but a long relationship for a bulk of his most prolific creative period was spent in a relationship with Jessica Lange. The part that always drove him nuts was being with a movie star cast an unwanted spotlight on his private life. Fool for Love, which was directed by Altman on stage and then made immediately into a film in the 1980s, which was a portrait of possibly incestuous bedmates who spend their lives running away from and toward each other as fast as they can, kind of represented a lot, Sam Shepard's romanticism and ideas of romantic relationships. What's interesting is that the play received its first Broadway production only 2 years ago, and it starred Sam Rockwell. The original production, not on Broadway, before it was made into a film, starred Ed Harris and Kathy Baker, and then of course, and then of course, Ed Harris would act with Sam Shepard in The Right Stuff.
Of course, but how many scene study classes does Fool for Love?
Like, oh, I know, Isn't that?
It's just like it's a staple. Like, that's why I'm shocked to hear it's never been on Broadway, considering the number of times and the number of scenes I've seen.
Well, you know, you mentioned his dad. You know, his dad is the cynical and yet romantic narrator of Fool for Love in a ghostly form. Sam Shepard, whose real name is Samuel Shepard Rogers III, was born in 43, and his dad was an alcoholic. And Sam Shepard, you'll love this, Sam Shepard Rogers, he was known as Steve Rogers all throughout his high school and childhood and adolescence. Yeah. growing up on his family's avocado farm in Duarte, California. Yeah, he was known as Steve Rogers, Captain America.
Look at that.
He worked in his youth as a stable hand, an orange picker, a sheep shearer. He moved briefly and attended Mount San Antonio College as an agriculture student, but dropped out to move to New York in 62, having discovered jazz and the plays of Samuel Beckett.
Wow.
Yeah, those were
those
the big
two are those are mind-blowing.
And indeed, when he got to New York, he started experimenting with LSD. Something else that people don't really know is his extensive work, not maybe extensive, but not insignificant work in music. He wrote songs with John Cale. He wrote songs with Bob Dylan, notably Brownsville Girl from Bob Dylan's 1986 album Knocked Out Loaded. And Dean Haglund, he was a drummer in a band called the Holy Modal Rounders, who once opened on tour for Pink Floyd.
No way.
Yes.
That's amazing. Okay, now I got to find that soundtrack.
We could go on and on about Sam Shepard. Truly one of a kind as an actor, as a writer. But that brings us to the end of another exciting installment. We've saved one celebrity death for next week, and I think it's okay. I think it's a good way to get back into that list, maybe, of films that all children should see before 14. And that was the death of Jeanne Moreau, the femme fatale of the French New Wave. She died at 89, and it is amazing. When you will set the stage, when you describe someone as an international star, I think it brings certain things to mind, and there was no greater international star than Jeanne Moreau. But we'll discuss that next week. For now, that's the end of this episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We've gone over time. People know how to find every show. They should write us like Julia Morena did at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Yes, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're Dean and Phil. Until next week, I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Lernis. Here's Tom Jones.
First he carved out young Abe Lincoln. Abe will teach him civil rights. Then a king named Martin Luther, so they'd recall his peaceful fight. Old Mark Twain, his wit and wisdom, we'll surely show them life is fun. But he smiled with satisfaction when the Prince of Peace was done. The young New Mexican puppeteer, he saw the people all lived in fear. He thought that maybe they'd listen to a puppet telling them what to do. And now he got some string and he got some wood. He did some carving and he was good. And folks came running so they could hear the young New Mexican puppeteer.
belated spoiler alert.